United States versus Bryant. Mr. Marsh, you are a little bit unique in this case, and the kind of sentence was handed down here, right?
I was just going to start with that, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Hanlon. It is a challenge to make an interesting argument as the last case on a whole morning full, maybe a week and a half full of Booker sentencing issues, but this case is different. Mr. Bryant pled guilty to a single count indictment charging him with being a felon in possession of a firearm and was sentenced in the district court following this court's decision in Booker and prior to the Supreme Court decision in Booker. Mr. Bryant raises errors in that sentence on two different levels. The first is a methodological or a general error that the court made, which is basically that while trying to anticipate all of the ways that the United States Supreme Court might decide the Booker case, the district court didn't anticipate the outcome which the Booker case, in fact, brought to us.
But it looks like if she didn't anticipate it, she came very close, because she says many different ways and times, I'm not relying on the guidelines, I'm following the Seventh Circuit's Booker case, the guidelines are unconstitutional, I'm using my discretion, I'm referring to the guidelines for advice, not for compulsion, if you will. The whole tenor of her remarks strikes me as something very much like what the Breyer opinion is contemplating for the future. And if that's the case, then how could she be wrong?
Well, I think she was wrong, Your Honor, in that while it's true, there's the district court, as she candidly said, was trying to announce the sentence in as many ways as possible so that it would be one that could be upheld following the Supreme Court's decision in the Booker case. But there are indications that are both under-inclusive and over-inclusive, though that's not exactly the right analogy. On the one hand, she said that she was announcing this decision in her total absolute discretion. It's as if she anticipated the Sentencing Reform Act being held to be unconstitutional, and the court was going back to the Williams analogy, whereby the court had the discretion to impose any sentence between 0 and 10 years. On the other hand, the whole process was indistinguishable from what the district courts were doing under the guidelines.
But don't you think that's going to be the case frequently going forward, that many district courts, you know, let's say in a trial that starts tomorrow and that we have sentencing on sometime thereafter, is going to, as the Supreme Court said, is going to look to the guidelines for advice, is going to say, I've done the calculations, here's the number that comes up, you know, it's 60 months or whatever, that seems like a reasonable sentence to me, and then the appeal will be taken on the ground that it wasn't reasonable, but surely this court, you know, isn't going to systematically find sentences calculated in accordance with the guidelines to be unreasonable. That would be in real tension with the Supreme Court, too. So what's...
Judge, it's an open question under Booker as to whether the district court should make these kind of specific guideline findings or should not make these kind of findings, and then what
Why
the...
Why do you think that's open when the remedy opinion says you should still look to the guidelines?
Well, and 3550A, of course, says that the court should consult the guideline ranges, which is even a little bit more specific, but my point is that's not an issue here because the district court judge did make those guideline findings, which is the second level of objection that Mr. Bryant has to the sentence, which is that the district court made errors in making those guideline determinations and that a sentence which is based on guideline determinations which are erroneous is not a reasonable sentence. And as the court knows from the briefs, there were two which were litigated in the district court. The most significant in terms both of the impact on Mr. Bryant's sentence and also in terms of the error, I suggest, is the finding that Mr. Bryant possessed this firearm in connection with another felony offense. The only evidence on that issue was what was in the pre-sentence investigation report, which was basically the government's version of the offense. I believe maybe the officer did testify that the house was small or something to that effect, but it was all hearsay. It was all at least double hearsay. As you know, Mr. Bryant's position is that if the district court is going to make those kind of factual determinations, which have the effect of increasing the sentence of the defendant, then the standard of proof is still beyond a reasonable doubt. And I, as I submitted in the brief, respectfully submit that the government here plainly did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Bryant possessed this firearm in connection with another felony offense. The district court's explanation of how she got to this conclusion is a little bit muddled. There are two separate clauses in that guideline, and it wasn't real clear exactly which of those she was going under. She said she didn't find that he committed a felony offense. There was a suggestion that maybe he possessed the a suggestion in the district court judge's findings that perhaps he possessed the firearm with reason to believe that somebody else was going to use it in a felony offense. There was absolutely no evidence of that. So that was an erroneous determination. It was clear from the whole...
But she did find beyond a reasonable doubt that he had, quote, the knowledge, intent, and reason to use or possess the firearm in connection with another felony offense. She doesn't go on and then sort of convict him of drug dealing, right, but she makes the connection finding.
She did make the right conclusion, Your Honor, in terms of reasonable doubt being the standard, but I submit to this court that that was a clearly erroneous finding. The evidence...
So you think you can't find things beyond a reasonable doubt unless the rules of evidence are followed?
No, I'm not pursuing the rules of evidence challenge here, but I am taking the position that if the only evidence before the court is the pre-sentence investigation report, and that is objected to, that the pre-sentence investigation report in and of itself cannot carry the burden of beyond a reasonable doubt.
Why not? I mean, other than the fact that it's hearsay and thus not within the rules of evidence.
Because if that is enough to satisfy beyond a reasonable doubt, what in practice happens, as the court is probably aware, is that the government, at least in our district, maybe this is not universal, at least in our district, the government submits their version of the offense to the probation officer. The probation officer puts that in the report as the official version of the offense. And if that's enough to satisfy the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, then that effectively shifts the burden of proof to the defendant to prove that the enhancement does not apply. And that would be, I suggest, plainly contrary to the requirement that the burden be on the government to prove the enhancement beyond a reasonable doubt. With respect to the other disputed guideline issue, again, our position simply is that the government did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the object on the end of the firearm in question was a flash suppressor. And that was the only issue. If it was a flash suppressor, this was a semi-automatic assault rifle as described in the statute. It had the other criteria. I actually offered on behalf of Mr. Bryant evidence that suggested that it was something called a flash hider rather than a flash suppressor. The agent testified he didn't really know the difference. In sum, Your Honor, the conclusion of the district court, again, was clearly erroneous. The burden was on the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that was a flash suppressor. That's the term of the statute, or at least the statute as it existed at that time. That statute no longer exists, and the government simply failed to prove that. Those two errors, I don't know whether the district court was required to make those factual determinations or not under Booker, but at least I suggest it's clear that if the district court does make those factual determinations and they're erroneous, then that results in a sentence which is not reasonable and it should be remanded. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maher. Mr. Hanlon.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is James Hanlon. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney and I represent the government in this matter. The fundamental issue before the court this morning is whether this court should remand this case to the district court for resentencing in light of Booker. The answer to that question is no. On the record before the court here, we have a sentencing methodology employed by the district court that followed the mandate of Booker. It was in compliance with everything that the Supreme Court's decision in Booker says. The process was fair to Mr. Bryant, and the sentence imposed to the court, imposed by the court, was a reasonable sentence.
Well, how do you answer Mr. Marsh's contention that if the guideline, and this is hypothetically, if the district judge had not follow the guidelines as she should have, the sentence would be unreasonable, even under the new Booker scheme?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question, Your Honor. Could you repeat it, please?
Well, Mr. Marsh has been arguing that there were two situations in which he felt that the guidelines, even if we were under a guideline scheme, were not properly followed in imposing this sentence. With regard to the firearm and the firearm the muzzle suppressor, flash suppression. And if she did that incorrectly, by preponderance of the evidence, as he described, would that make the sentence unreasonable?
The sentence would not be unreasonable, as the court has already pointed out, as I believe Judge Wood already pointed out. Judge Barker, in fact, made both of these findings.
Well, but I guess what Judge Kaney's getting at, and this is going to be very important to this court going forward, is when district judges say, I've used the guidelines as guidance, they're going to be making all these same findings, you know, that we're accustomed to, whether it's flash suppressor for guns in that era or whether it's obstruction or whether it's whatever it is. And sometimes, of course, district court judges in the old days got reversed on their guidelines findings. They either misinterpreted the legal scope of the guidelines or they clearly erred when they found facts. And is that going to be enough going forward to make the sentence unreasonable if the district court, using the guidelines for guidance, makes a mistake, as Mr. Marsh has argued happened here?
Well,
I mean, I understand you're going to argue that she didn't make a mistake, but
right.
Supposing for the sake of argument that she did, does that make it an unreasonable sentence?
The government's view would be that a sentence imposed within the applicable guideline range is presumptively reasonable.
Right, and so what if they make a mistake about the guideline range? Every now and then the government loses an appeal that a defendant takes, or at least, again, the ancien regime, you know, the government would every now and then lose an appeal on the guidelines. That was a straightforward matter in the old world. In the new world, is that going to be enough to show that the sentence was unreasonable?
I believe that while the view, obviously, as I already said, is that a sentence within the range is presumptively reasonable, I think that the government's view going further is that a sentence within the applicable range is not the only reasonable
sentence. But what if there were, what if the range was miscalculated, either because of a legal error or clearly erroneous fact-finding by the district court?
I suppose that the analysis that the court would want to look at then would be to step back and take a look at the factors under 3553A, which is ultimately what's controlling the court's decision as to an appropriate sentence.
Do you think this new reasonableness review equates to abuse of discretion?
It is not per se abuse of discretion, or at least I should say I'm not in a position to represent that the department feels it is per se an abuse of discretion. But I think that analogously, when we look to the standard of review that applies to a sentence imposed in a supervised release violation context, which is plainly unreasonable, which is obviously a very deferential standard, and then if we go back a little bit in time and look at under the old law, when a sentencing judge would depart from the guidelines, the degree of the departure was reviewed for an abuse of discretion. So I suppose that the analogy would be looking at how far from the presumptively reasonable guideline range did the judge stray, and then looking at that under a highly deferential standard of review is the best way that I can describe it at this time. As far as the other, I think that one of the important points I'd like to make is that Judge Barker specifically described the guidelines here as a measure or standard that she would use in applying her discretion. The reason why I think that that's very important here is two of the most significant goals of moving away from an indeterminate sentencing regime were uniformity in sentencing and also being sure that sentencing reflects real conduct. And the reason why the judge increased Mr. Bryant's sentence here, the factors Mr. Marsh talked about in the guidelines, really are just a way of quantifying the nature and circumstances of the offense, which is one of the main factors that the court has always taken into account under 3553A. And that is that Mr. Bryant was not passively possessing a gun, but the evidence presented at the sentencing hearing showed that he clearly was engaged in illegal activity and that these guns furthered that activity. And the evidence also did show that one of the guns, regardless of what the device on the end was called, whether it's called a suppressor, or a hider, the evidence in the transcript before the judge was that what that does is it makes the weapon more dangerous to law enforcement officers. And so Judge Barker looked at all those factors and sentenced Mr. Bryant according to the real offense conduct that he engaged in here. And I would also like to make just one final point, and that is in some of the earlier arguments we had this morning, I think it was the Seeley case, there was a discussion of the Crosby case out of the Second Circuit. And that is a case that the government cited in its 28J letter. I think the very important distinguishing factor between this case and the Crosby case is that here Judge Barker, right after the guilty plea was accepted, made her legal ruling that she would not be bound by the guidelines and that she was going to use them as advisory, but that she was very clear, as Judge Wood already pointed out, the range was 0 to 10 years, and she would fashion a sentence using her discretion. Therefore, at the sentencing hearing, both the government and the defense had the opportunity to put on any facts and any arguments that they thought would be relevant in fashioning a sentence within that wide range. And in fact, at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Marsh advocated a non-guideline sentence of 5 years in this case. So he obviously was aware at the sentencing hearing that the court was going to fashion a sentence within the statutory range and not be bound by the guidelines, so he was free there to go ahead and present any argument and facts, and that would seem to address the primary concern articulated by the Second Circuit in the Crosby case, which is that both the litigants and the judge didn't have the opportunity to think about and present facts and arguments that might have been out of play in a mandatory guideline system. So the sentence imposed here was reasonable. That's a standard of review that this court should apply. The district court did not err at all when it imposed this sentence in this case. If the panel has no other questions, the government would request that the court affirm the judgment of the district court below. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hannon. Ms. Marsh, how much? 2 minutes. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I cited the Crosby case in my supplemental brief, not for the proposition that this court should remand this case for a Crosby-type determination, because this is not a plain error case in any respect. I only cited it for the proposition that the Crosby case said just because there are alternative sentences doesn't mean that it is right. Secondly, I want to try to answer the question a couple of you raised in with Mr. Hanlon, and that is 3553A4 requires the court to consider the guideline ranges, and Booker says that the court should consult the guidelines. Now, it's still an open question, as I said earlier, whether the court has to make these kind of specific findings or whether the court can just say, well, I've looked at the guidelines and the government's position is this and the defendant's position is this, and I'm taking all that into account. That may be where we end up. But I would suggest that if the court does make specific guideline determinations and does make a determination that this is the correct range, then it would be totally irrational to say, even if the district court gets it wrong, that doesn't matter, because it does matter. And if the district court gets it wrong, then that this court should tell the district court that and should remand it for a resentencing with the court considering the correct guideline range. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks again to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and I'm sure we'll continue this week with more Booker cases.